was unsure how many people were based there from one day to the next. He knew that a lot of the staff were bussed in daily, though he was not allowed to speak to them, and that regulations concerning leaving one's designated area, even one's quarters, were strictly enforced. Sometimes it felt like he was alone, the sole worker surrounded by security teams who had nothing else to do but watch him. His lodging was a prefabricated trailer that sported an AC unit that sounded like a jet engine. At first, he assumed this was just because the device was working at maximum capacity to counter the extreme Nevada heat. But then he was summoned to one of the base's office complexes and noticed something strange. The decor was coolly, nondescriptly professional, and the windowless interior might have passed for the halls and offices of a major New York law firm. But the carpeted halls featured trim black wall-mounted speakers, generating a soft white noise hiss. It was a counter-surveillance mechanism. Even the most sophisticated listening devices would struggle to cut through the static. Maybe his air conditioner had been designed with the same secondary function in mind. In his trailer, he read, listened to music, or played video games. There was no internet to connect him with the cyber world off base, until summoned. Then he was escorted to wherever he would spend the bulk of the day, flashing his badge and scanning his palm print at every door, breaking for meals in the DFAC, which was invariably deserted, except for whoever was serving him his gastronomic treat for the day. He turned in his dinner requests the night before, amusing himself by challenging the cooks with exotic dishes he had only read about. So far, he had tried wild boar with roasted chestnuts and truffles, duck à l'orange, and, just for devilment, vegan shepherd's pie. He hadn't tripped them up yet, though after the shepherd's pie, he asked for a ribeye steak, cooked rare, which might have been the greatest thing he ever tasted. He spent 90 minutes a day in the well-appointed gym while he waited for someone to tell him what the hell he was doing here. The second week was spent in classes, again by himself, being instructed on the nature of the craft he would be flying. Alan privately nicknamed his instructor Professor Beaker, after the Muppet. Half of what Alan was told comprised nodules of information coherent in their own right, but not clearly connected to each other, so that he felt he was learning about individual systems, the purpose of which remained a mystery. The other half was just technobabble, and though he was good at parroting it back, it meant little to him. The craft itself, according to its data manual, was triangular, and was named the Astra TR-3B. "But we just call it the Locust," said Beaker with a smile. He was proud to be connected to it. The Locust had control layouts unlike those used in any aircraft he had ever seen, controls that were not just unfamiliar, but counterintuitive to anyone with a basic sense of aviation or aerospace physics. "Which is why you can't think of space and time as separate entities," Professor Beaker was saying. "Is that clear, Major?" Alan had to fight the urge to laugh. Clear? It was, to him, gibberish. It meant nothing. But did he understand the words themselves? "Sure. Absolutely, Professor," he said. "You don't need to call me that," said Professor Beaker, looking slightly puzzled, before turning back to the diagram he had scribbled on the whiteboard. "So, you see, the curvature in space-time can be exploited by applying, as it were, pressure here and here." He tapped the diagram and then noted Alan's raised hand. "Yes, Major?" "So, this is what?" said Alan. He tried not to sound skeptical. "Warp drive?" Professor Beaker blinked like a baby bird in the sun, scowled, then finally smiled. It looked like it took real effort. "Good one," he said. "It's good to keep a sense of humor. Warp drive. Very good, Major." He smiled wider, as if he had made a joke. Alan appreciated that Professor Beaker was trying to help him in his way. They just didn't speak the same language, or, Alan thought ruefully, inhabit the same version of reality. "We'll break for lunch," said Beaker. "Then we'll begin work on the Locust's weapon systems." "Yes," said Alan, sitting up. "I was wondering about that. I can't make sense out of these design specs. There's no nose cannon?" Again, Beaker's bird-like blink indicated he was unsure if Alan was trying to be funny. "Nose cannon?" said Beaker, as if he had never heard the words before. "Right. Lasers," said Beaker, as if nothing could be more obvious. "In 1956, the pilot of a Grumman F-11 F-1 Tiger, traveling at the speed of sound, shot itself down when its speed allowed it to accidentally fly into the path of its own slowing bullets. We've been a little wary of conventional weapons for superfast aircraft ever since." "So," said Alan, "we've got lasers." Beaker smiled vaguely. "Nothing faster than light, is there? I'm sorry. Was that not in the briefing?" Alan, who had been staring in stunned silence, rallied. "Not in those precise terms," he managed. He was glad when lunch break arrived. He'd crossed over into a world that didn't make any real sense, however much everyone behaved as if it did. That sense stayed with him throughout the afternoon briefings. He listened, he studied, he aced his quizzes, but he felt like the only sober one at a party where everyone else was drunk or high. Lasers? It was nuts. That night, he told Hatcher he was getting restless, that he didn't know what he was doing there, and that he was starting to think they had made a serious mistake. "We'll see if you feel that way tomorrow," said Hatcher. "You've completed the first phase of your training." So Beaker had given him a passing grade after all. "What happens tomorrow?" Alan asked, unconvinced. He didn't see how he'd been training for anything. "Brave new world," said Hatcher. Alan slept little that night. When Hatcher came for him the next morning, he'd been up and dressed for almost 2 hours. "We're flying today?" he asked. It seemed like a long time since he'd been in a cockpit. "Good morning to you too, Major," said Hatcher. "And no, today we're in simulators." Alan's heart sank. He was tired of being treated like a rookie. "Is that really necessary?" he said. "I've racked up thousands of hours in the air. Are these ships so different that I have to start over?" "Yes," said Hatcher, simply. Outside was a yellow school bus with blacked-out windows and a driver in shades who verified their IDs before setting off without a word. "Where are we going?" asked Alan. "You ask too many questions," said Hatcher. "We're going to another part of the base, a separate restricted part." "I thought the whole area was restricted." "There are levels. Where we're going is classified as S4, Papoose Lake, south of the mountains. You'll be spending a lot of time there, and you won't be discussing it with anyone. Ever. Clear?" "Crystal." The bus rumbled over what felt like a dirt road. Alan could see nothing but the occasional bleed of white Nevada sunlight through scratches in the blacked-out windows. When they stopped and got out, the terrain looked much as it had. Dry, pale ground, and another evaporated lake bed at the base of a wall of cliffs, utterly desolate, without any sign of human habitation, until they approached the cliff face, turned into a shaded alcove, and came to a door with a keypad. Alan did a double take. From a few feet away, the door was nearly invisible. "Avert your eyes," said Hatcher, casual, but not messing around. Alan did so. Inside, they walked down cool, white-noised corridors, stopping at security doors that looked like they belonged in a submarine, sliding open only after Hatcher had entered codes in a palm print. Alan said nothing, oscillating between annoyance and a swelling sense of excitement. Planes were planes. They had their varying quirks and capabilities, and it made sense that pilots specialized in particular models as a result. But at its core, flying was flying. He knew, in his very bones, the essential elements of thrust and lift, of banking, acceleration, G-force, pitch, roll, you name it. It was a part of him. Who was Hatcher kidding with all this cloak and dagger teasing? The CIA man walked him into a locker room, opened one of the steel wall cabinets, and dragged out a flight suit, not so very different from what Alan had worn over the mountains of Afghanistan. He dressed, and Hatcher stood by, watching like a critical parent, poised to offer help or criticism. Alan welcomed neither. When he was ready, they proceeded through another door, and Hatcher nodded towards a familiar dark-eyed man standing at a console, dressed in a matching flight suit. "You already know Mr. Marat." Alan didn't bother concealing his surprise. "I didn't know you were a pilot," he said, assuming the man was here to monitor the simulator while Alan was inside. "Many thanks," said Marat with a flat smile, "including your tutor for the day. I'll be monitoring your progress today, and we'll be in constant radio contact." "I'll be fine," said Alan, needled. "No doubt," said Marat. "Through here." He nodded towards another door. "You ready?" asked Hatcher. "For a simulator?" asked Alan, trying to keep the edge out of his voice. "Absolutely." "Good," he said, smiling his slim private smile that suggested he knew something Alan didn't. "Follow Mr. Marat's lead, and don't try to run before you can walk." "Yes, sir," said Alan, eyes level, face impassive. "And don't worry if it doesn't come to you right away," Hatcher added. Alan didn't trust himself to say anything. He managed a curt nod and turned to Marat as the door to the simulator slid open with a pneumatic hiss. He hesitated in the doorway. The room was large and unremarkable, save for the simulator that sat in the center like a giant spider, trailing cables and air hoses leading to various monitoring stations. Alan put on his helmet and scaled the gantry, waiting as the steel panel in front of him folded down on the hydraulics, providing motion simulation. The simulators he was familiar with had high-definition flat screens and speaker arrays, recreating the sights and sounds of being inside a plane. But the experience of flying, the tug in your gut, the sense of gravitational rightness or wrongness as you banked, turned, and climbed, all came from the hydraulics. But he'd never seen this model before. Assuming it was state-of-the-art, he felt a tingle of anticipation. There was that Dutch simulator he'd read about, called Desdemona, that was supposed to be able to generate something like 3.5 Gs. That would be pretty cool. Maybe this would have the same capabilities. His first response, as he stepped inside the simulator cockpit and closed the door behind him, was disappointment. The Martin Baker ejection seat could have come straight out of an F-16. It was only as he climbed in that the strangeness of the controls struck him. The jets he knew had Hotas systems, with all the significant control mounted on either the stick in his right hand or the throttle quadrant in his left. Here, the thrust control lever was on his right-hand armrest, and on the left, there was a red sphere sitting in a cradle. Okay. He had seen the control layout before, during Professor Beaker's tutorials, but he hadn't expected them to be real. Not real. This is a simulator. He belted himself into his seat and put his hands instinctively on the unfamiliar controls. The consoles, which ran all the way round the cockpit in a series of lit panels, flickered to life, showing a range of digital displays that Alan knew from his classwork. He heard the intercom system click on in his earphones, and a moment later, he heard Marat's voice. "Poised to engage simulated environment. Do you have a preferred venue?" "Does it matter?" "If in doubt, I go to Paris," said Marat, deciding for him. "Charles de Gaulle Airport it is." Alan rolled his eyes and tapped on the touch-sensitive console, watching the displays as he engaged the simulator's navigation systems. One of them displayed the locust itself, another graphic he had seen during his 2 weeks of study, but hadn't really believed. It was a perfect triangle, with a couple of fins on the trailing edge, the only way you could determine for sure which corner was the nose. To Allen, the closest known aircraft that came to mind was the B-2 stealth bomber. But this was not so much a flying wing with the B-2's characteristic jagged trailing edge, as a perfectly equilateral triangle with soft curved points. The sheer lines of the plane, if you could still call a locust a plane, were just so unlike his awkward but trusty Harrier II that he could barely imagine himself getting inside it. "I've never flown a stealth aircraft," he said, conscious that he was already covering his ass, in case the simulation didn't go well. "Shouldn't you use pilots with that kind of training?" "Trust me," said Morant over the radio. "It wouldn't help. This is different." There was a flicker of light from above. Allen looked up, realizing for the first time that he had a continuous window all the way around the craft, looking out over its bizarre triangular shape. Overhead, he saw a patchy blue sky, while the horizon was cluttered with the radar towers, hangars, sheds, and passenger terminals of a bustling modern airport. He whistled. "That's quite a simulation." "Thought it would be less than top of the line, Major?" said Hatcher's voice over the intercom. "I'm offended." Allen said nothing. He felt under the microscope and didn't like it. "The Eiffel Tower is just under 40 clicks to your southwest," said Morant. "Why not take a look?" "Okay," said Allen. "Oh, and you're no longer Black Eagle," said Hatcher. "Your code name is now Phoenix. Your controller, who you know as Mr. Morant, is Nightbird 1, base out." "Roger that, base," said Allen. "Initiating takeoff." "Welcome to the future, Phoenix," said Morant. "I'll talk you through this first time. As you know, the sphere on your left armrest is directional control. On the right, you've got acceleration and altitude adjustment. These can be overridden by entering preset coordinates into the console and the dialog box with the green rim. The temporal index controls arrival time. The computer will do the rest, unless there's interference with the flight path. These dials set your customizable menu options for cruising speed, altitude, radar countermeasures, the works. Let's leave them as they are for now." Allen was determined not to ask questions, unless absolutely necessary. Gradually, the controls were making sense to him, as everything he'd seen in two-dimensional abstract terms in Professor Beaker's classes became real. "Well, almost real. You are still in a simulator." "You have to unlearn a few things about flying," said Morant. "But don't worry. It'll make sense to your body. Let's get in the simulated air, and you'll see what I mean." "Wait, I don't understand," Allen began, hating the way he sounded. So uncertain, so confused. It was only a damn simulator, for God's sake. "Okay, so let's take her up," said Morant. "Straight up, no runway. As a Harrier pilot, you should like this. You're used to a single engine directed by multiple movable nozzles, so you can direct the thrust straight down, behind, or at an angle that changes the plane's attitude, right?" "Right," said Allen, feeling a little more comfortable. This was stuff he knew. "Yeah," said Morant, and Allen could just hear the grin in his voice. "This is totally different." Allen bit his lip. "I think I can take it from here. Thanks, Nightbird One," he said. More switches, then a push of vertical thrust. The ship gave the distinct wobble of a craft leaving the ground, but slowly, moving on a rising column of force. Through the cockpit viewers, Allen saw the simulated Parisian tarmac fall away beneath him, and then the ship hung motionless in the perfectly faked afternoon light. It was an impossible climb, straight and quick and easy, quite unlike the Bronco ride of a Harrier. Nothing flew like this. Allen's face in the simulator took a hit. He forced himself to look around the inside of the single-seat craft, and the display panel surrounding the unconventionally roomy interior, and he saw what Marat meant. The interface was uncommonly commonsensical. The screens overlaying the live digital diagrams of the ship's attitude, clear, requiring neither training nor complex explanation. Despite the lights and scrolling displays, it was all remarkably self-evident and intuitive, though it was hard to imagine that it mirrored the interior of the actual craft. "When you're happy with the altitude," said Marat over the headset, "move towards the coordinates on your nav display." Alan turned the sphere under his hand, and the craft rotated, cleanly, too cleanly, in the air. He applied a little thrust, and he was moving. The landmarks of Paris, including the Eiffel Tower, zipping past them in a blur. He pursed his lips. State of the art it might be, but it didn't feel like flight. No aircraft could pivot on a dime like he had just done. Then he registered the heads-up display. "That can't be right," he muttered. "Phoenix, the Nightbird 1, I've got some readout anomalies." "Go ahead, Phoenix." "The console says we just went from 0 to 400 knots in under a second." "Not in a Harrier now, Major," said Marat. "No," Alan agreed. "I'm in a simulator." "The best in the business," said Marat. "If you say so," said Alan, increasing speed. He felt the pull of G-force on his face and the pressure in his chest, but it was nothing like what he should be feeling at this speed. "How's that?" asked Marat. "Fine," said Alan, refusing to be impressed, and not only because he felt the honor of his beloved Harriers had been called into question. "But there's a lot of things you can do in a simulator that would pull you apart if you were really in the air." In response, Marat's voice came over the headset. "Why do I feel like it's us who are being tested?" "Just want to see how wide of reality we really are," said Alan. "You need to work on your outlook, Phoenix. It's very cynical." "Sorry about that, Nightbird 1," said Alan, pushing the craft faster still. They were now going well beyond Mach 1. But the simulator felt as smooth as ever, even when he jinked the directional sphere back and forth, half rolling the little digital triangle, which showed the locust's imaginary attitude. "I just like simulators that actually, you know, simulate what the act of flying feels like. It's an eccentricity of mine." "You're going to have to trust me that it is doing exactly that." "Right. Okay, Nightbird 1, what tricks do you want to show me?" "Let's try a hard left. Really hard. Like 90 degrees.
90 degrees?
"Yeah. Point at Africa and go." Alan, annoyed, did so, pushing the ball hard so that the great triangle slewed around without losing a single notch of speed.
"See?" said Marat.
"Uh-huh," said Alan, "though I'm pretty sure I could do that in an X-Wing on PlayStation."
"Can your X-Wing do a vertical climb at Mach 5, make a right-angle turn and come to a dead stop?" asked Marat.
"Probably not," said Alan, his irritation getting the better of him.
"But that's my point. Nothing can. So why am I wasting time pulling impossible stunts? Are you going to use me as an actual pilot, or are we just playing video games?"
"You hear that, base?" said Marat. "I think we've been issued a challenge, requesting an unscheduled shift to Phase 2.
There was a moment of radio silence, and then Hatcher's voice came in over the intercom.
"Let me see what I can arrange, gentlemen.
Ascertaining full Phase 2 clearance. Stand by."
"Wait," said Alan.
"What?
I don't understand."
"Something has come up," said Marat. "We need to accelerate your training."
"Meaning what?"
"I think it's time you got out of the simulator and up in the air."
21. Jennifer. Hampshire.
"Well?" Jennifer asked. "Details are proving difficult to locate," said Deacon.
"That's the understatement of the fucking year," she answered.
"Sorry," she added, noting the shock on the older man's face. "But it's like they go out of their way to bury any useful information about what they're actually doing."
They were back at the house, huddled in the glow of computer screens at a single desk light, where they had been for almost 2 hours, as darkness fell on the gardens outside. Jennifer had changed into jeans and a sweatshirt, and had hastily disassembled the maddening French twist, so that she kept having to brush her hair out of her face. She didn't care.
"And you are absolutely sure that this is your copy of the agenda?" asked Deacon.
They had had this conversation twice since the board meeting. Deacon had thought that perhaps she'd absent-mindedly underlined the item referring to the special aerospace package herself, or had picked up someone else's copy.
"If it's supposed to be a message to you," he said when she protested, "it is singularly unhelpful."
But then again, it was all unhelpful. The Maynard Consortium had a snappy website, and brochures, and interminable files detailing its various accounts and investments. But it all seemed to end in cascades of numbers. What they were actually investing in was anybody's guess. The numbers were not exclusively misleading, however. Whatever that aerospace investment was, it was expensive. Billions of dollars, funneled over the last 6 months alone. But to fund what? Even her father's laptop had been unable to shed light on that.
"These files make no sense," she remarked to Deacon, as she pored over them.
"Most of the directories are empty, and the accounts they do show explain only about a tenth of the funding." She sighed, then whistled.
"Nigeria has a space agency? And Saudi Arabia? This is weird."
Deacon materialized at her shoulder.
"Maynard is funding the Nigerian Space Agency?" he asked.
"And the Sri Lankan Space Agency, if you can believe that. And the ones in Bangladesh, Tunisia, and Pakistan. That's a pretty strange list of bedfellows, even without the space agency bit."
"But the funding levels are low," Deacon mused, peering at the screen.
"So where is the rest of it going, and why can't we see it?"
"Perhaps there's nothing to see," said Deacon.
"Let's be honest, Miss Jennifer. We don't even know we're reading the data correctly. This may just be an accounting convention, or a matter of how money is transferred through channels. If the bulk of the money goes to UK interests, it could be recorded differently, routed through companies with strong governmental ties, such as British Aerospace, whose records are confidential or classified. Or maybe someone doctored the laptop to remove whatever they thought we'd find interesting," Jennifer countered.
Deacon sat beside her and, for a moment, said nothing.
When she turned to look at him, he was watching her with a troubled frown.
"What?" she said.
"Miss Jennifer."
"Just call me Jennifer, please," she said. "This Miss thing makes me feel like I'm 12 years old.
"Jennifer," he said, laying the word out like it was a gift, wrapped and ribboned for Christmas. "Have you considered the possibility that there's nothing to find? That you are hunting for something you want to be there, because it will give your father's death a sense of purpose it doesn't really have?"
She had considered that. Of course she had, but she was surprised to hear him say it.
"Someone wanted me to look into this," she said, indicating the agenda item someone on the Maynard Consortium board had underlined.
"Perhaps," said Deacon, "but if so, it's more likely to be a rather mean-spirited joke at your expense than a pointer toward nefarious activities."
She would have bristled, but this use of the word nefarious brought her up short, but she couldn't help but grin.
"Did I say something amusing?" he asked.
She shook her head and patted his hand.
"It was cool. Ridged with bone, liver-spotted, and latticed with prominent veins. Old hands."
"I don't know," she said. "Maybe you're right. I just feel like..." But she didn't know what she felt. Not really. She pushed the rolling chair away from her father's heavy desk and stretched out.
"Perhaps you should call it a night," said Deacon. "Get some rest and take a look with fresh eyes tomorrow."
"When I'll see that I've lost my mind," Jennifer said, "and give up?"
"Not precisely what I meant," said Deacon, conceding the half-truth.
He saw the disappointment in her face and relented.
"Do you mind if I just check something?" he asked, nodding at the laptop.
Jennifer shrugged got up and perched on the edge of the desk, staring absently at the little wooden lion she'd wanted to believe was significant. He had probably stopped facing it towards him a decade ago. She wouldn't know. She hadn't really known him for years. She might have lapsed further into nostalgia and sadness. But something in Deacon's manner had changed. He was sitting very still, as his focus on the computer sharpened. "What?" asked Jennifer. "There's a keystroke logger he installed," said Deacon, not looking at her, "a month ago. He said he was growing forgetful and wanted to keep track of what he had been doing and when. You have to know exactly where to go to find it. He hid it because he said he'd hate to have someone else spot it and think he was losing mental acumen. I didn't think much of it at the time, though it did strike me as out of character. And, according to this, the computer was active for 2 hours, the day after he died, and again, for four more, the day after that. So someone took it and rifled its contents, possibly deleting as they went. But inexpertly," Deacon mused. "You think any deleted data might be recoverable?" Jennifer asked. "In the right hands, and with time, possibly. Though that is beyond my area of expertise," said Deacon. "Which is suggestive. A professional would surely destroy the machine and replace it. The person who did this doesn't seem to know that deleted material doesn't truly go away, or assume no one would look too closely." "Meaning me," said Jennifer, with bitter amusement. "Indeed," said Deacon. "But then someone sends you a cryptic message that guarantees you will. So either you have two different people pulling you in two different directions, or one person laying out breadcrumbs," she concluded for him. "Precisely," said Deacon. "I'm not sure which possibility is more troubling. Don't breadcrumbs lead to the gingerbread house and the witch's oven?" "I believe that is the traditional outcome, yes," Deacon agreed. "Then let's pull for option one," said Jennifer. "I assume you've already got everything relating to Dad's business interests out of the safe?" "And his various safety deposit boxes, yes," said Deacon. "If he hid pertinent information elsewhere, I'm afraid I don't know where." For a moment, Jennifer grew very still, and her eyes glazed. "Surely not." "Miss Jennifer?" Deacon prompted. "Nothing," she said, shaking off the reverie. "I suppose I'm more exhausted than I thought. Time for me to turn in." He hesitated for a half second, and there was the beginning of a question on his lips, but he thought better of it. "Anything I can bring you before bed?" he asked, standing. "No," she said. "Wait. Yes. Whiskey. The Lagavulin. Her father's favorite." "Certainly," said Deacon. "I'll bring it to your room." Jennifer showered and changed into flannel pajamas and a terrycloth dressing gown. For all its opulence, the house was always cold, even in summer. The alternative was a heating system that made the place stuffy and humid. She sipped the scotch Deacon had left on her nightstand, but made no move to go to bed, waiting instead for the noises of the house to still. 20 minutes later, she went barefoot along the hall, feeling the chill from the polished wood floors as she went past her father's study, past his bedroom, and past what had been her playroom, to what had been, effectively, his. She took a sip of the whiskey she was still cradling, savoring its complex, heady flavors, feeling strange to be here, like a kid awoken by a nightmare, looking for her father. Once more, the memory of disturbing her father in his study that night, the one night he had shouted, came back to her, but she didn't know what it meant. Not wanting to remember him like that, she shrugged it off. Instead, she tried the door. For the briefest, anguished moment, she felt sure she would find him inside. If Edward Quinn's office had been his inner sanctum, this was his secret treasure trove, the one place he never discussed with his business colleagues, his hideout, where he could indulge all he was, not in daily life. In here, he had been, she imagined, a boy again. It contained one thing only. Vast and glorious, though it was. A model railway, painstakingly built, remodeled and maintained for decades. It was where he had gone when everyone was in bed, and he needed to escape his work. It was, she supposed, where they'd had their last truly intimate connections. Here she had sat in silence, painting minuscule cows and gluing bits of lichen to trees, while he soldered points and fiddled with signal gantries. Quality time, they would call it now. She hated the glibness of the words, the easy way they pigeonholed that made ordinary what had once been special. It was all still here, as she knew it would be. She snapped the switch beside the outlet and turned on the transformer, as if she'd done it yesterday and the day before. There had, in fact, been, what, 15 years? Something like that. She turned the dial, familiar as her own hand, and heard a train stir. On the far side, in a siding beside the village she had childishly christened Christmas, because that portion of the layout was laid out in snow around a frozen pond, the Flying Scotsman, always her favorite, emerged with its tender and a pair of passenger coaches. She gave it a little more speed to get it up the incline, and as it hit the great outer loop, watched with an old and poignant delight that brought tears to her eyes. For 5 minutes, she just let it run, absorbing the familiar sound of the wheels on the track, and then she moved to the carefully molded hill, with the model mine, and its beautifully crafted elevator tower and hopper loaders. It looked perfect, meticulously executed, like a real place seen from a great height. She reached across the track to where a tunnel bore into the side of the hill, its rocky escarpments cunningly made of plaster and cork bark, took hold of the escarpment with her hand spread wide, and tested it. It shifted slightly and, with a little pressure from side to side, lifted free. The hill was hollow. The idea had been first to give access to the track inside the tunnel, in case carriages derailed or faults developed on the line, but it had quickly become their secret hiding place. The spot he would leave cream eggs and other forbidden goodies for her to find. She reached inside, feeling around with the care of someone accustomed to dealing with delicate parts and tiny electronics, but felt nothing but plywood, papier-mâché, and dust. She was withdrawing her hand when something small and hard dislodged and skidded away. Fingers spread, she tried again, slower this time, and came out clutching a thumb drive. 22. Tamika, Pottsville, Pennsylvania. The man in the suit was coming for her across the Hollows golf course. She did not think. She rolled up onto her feet and broke into a run back into the woods. Somewhere there would be a wrought iron fence, and beyond it, a road. If her estimation of her position was right, she wouldn't have to go far to reach Dion's car. Unless they'd already found it. Unless they caught her first. Unless the fence was too high to climb, or the gatekeeper was waiting for her on the other side. She had no choice. She ran. The ground was uneven, strewn with branches and rotting leaves, so that every step was ragged, and every jump risked a fall. She checked over her shoulder. The man was moving faster now and had already reached the cart path. He was also reaching under his jacket. Wide-eyed, she ran, plunging up through the woods, desperation driving her forward. She could see nothing but trees ahead. He was gaining on her, and now he had his pistol drawn. God! She wove her way through the trees in case he started shooting. Yet, though she heard him shouting as he ran, there was no gunfire. She thought wildly about the man who had chased her through the streets of Manhattan, dressed as a cop. He had fired at her,
even with crowds of people around. People who could have been hit. People who could have been witnesses. So why hadn't this guy started shooting yet? And then, looming ahead of her, was a wrought iron fence, the perimeter of the Hollows estate. It was perhaps 10 feet high, with no handholds. She felt her pace flag, as something like despair threatened to overcome her. But she ran on, looking for a tree she could climb, a limb that might get her over the fence. There was one. It was a ragged, blackened, spindly thing, leafless and blasted, as if it had been struck by lightning. Tamika made for it, vaulting and scrabbling as soon as she reached it, dragging herself awkwardly up and out, going just high enough to inch out over the fence, each railing tipped with a fleur-de-lis spear point. Her pursuer had nearly caught her, his shouts now directed at her. "Stop where you are," he called, but even now he did not shoot. Tamika was suddenly sure he was quite different from the man calling himself Cook, who had pursued her in New York. She kept moving, just as he reached the foot of the tree. She dropped over the fence into a ditch. The road was there. She ran until she saw her car parked where she had left it. It was the most beautiful thing she had ever seen. She glanced in the rearview mirror as she sped away. She checked into a motel where the desk clerk, thankfully, didn't ask a lot of questions, and took a long hot shower, watching the detritus of mud and leaves she rinsed from her hair go slowly down the drain. She was not very hungry, and decided she would rather not risk being out and about, only a few miles from the Hollows, so she curled up on the uneven mattress and read from Jersey Stern's journal. It made strange reading. She began to wonder if she had been crazy to put so much stock in the old man and his poignant but insane ramblings. But then, the people who had come after her were more than serious. Could it all be true? And if so, what did it finally mean? She took a pair of nail scissors from her purse and used them to slit the lining of the Navy officer's coat just to the side of the vent in the back, then slipped the journal inside. It wouldn't stand up to a thorough search, but if someone was in a rush and just checked the pockets or gave her a pat-down, she might get away with it. She put the coat on, feeling the weight of the book in the back, as she considered herself in the mirror. Not bad, all things considered. She thought again about the difference between the feel of the two chases she'd gone through. The fake cops who had come after her in Manhattan had wanted her dead. There was no doubt about that. At the Hollows, the pursuit had felt somehow more restrained, even law-abiding. Despite her attempts to conceal herself in the caterer's van, she was pretty sure the gate guard had spotted her, but he'd let her through. Why? He'd called for backup. They'd hoped to corner her in the house. It meant they'd wanted to catch her. Even when she'd gotten away from them, they hadn't opened fire. So, two different groups were after her. One wanted her dead, the other, at least for a while, alive. One was reckless and had no concern for the law. The other, she wasn't sure. Those suits and earpieces seemed authentic, in ways the fake cops hadn't. And that meant... government? She frowned and thought back to Katerina's evasion when she'd been asked what kind of work she'd been in. What had she said? That strange phrase that so unsettled Tamika. Paper people, hidden away in a drawer, where no one can read us. At the time, it had reminded her of something, but she wasn't sure what. Like there was another word, just beyond her memory's reach. An ordinary word, but somehow loaded with meaning. Paper people. She thought of Jersey's journal, and something struck her. She flipped through her notebook and found the list of names the caterer had given her. Horace Evers, Stephen Alberts, Katerina Lundegrass, Albert Billen, Frederick Kass, Carl Jurgens, Max Steigler. She looked at them again and realized that most of them, perhaps even all of them, sounded German. Coincidence? She doubted it.
paper people. Suddenly, her memory chimed once more, and this time, she had the word she had been groping for. She called Marvin. He answered on the first ring, babbling inquiries about her health and welfare. "I'm fine," she answered. "How are things there?" "Quiet," he said. "Audrey called in sick, so it's just me." "Question," she said. "What do you know about Operation Paperclip?" She could almost hear his mind focus. Like the mechanism of a microscope adjusting, creating sharpness and clarity, where there had been a blurry nothingness. Marvin was a computer whiz kid, but that was only half his value to debunction. He was also a fount of wisdom on conspiracy theories, and an expert at sifting through the hype, the mysticism and the drama, for kernels of truth. He pulled up some pertinent data as he talked, but in spite of his technological gifts, Marvin was very much a book guy when it came to hard data. "Books aren't slippery like websites," he liked to say. "You know where they come from and what they're worth. No one vets what you post online." But he didn't need either to recall Operation Paperclip. "There's still some stuff we don't know about the scale of the program and exactly who is in it," he said. "But there's also a lot we do know." "Know or guess?" Tamika prompted. "No," said Marvin, with none of his usual stoner vagueness. "It's a matter of historical record. There may be conspiracies attached to it, but the core has been public and verified for decades. Give me the gist. At the end of World War II, the Nazis were frantically developing high-tech weapons to turn the tide. Jet planes, ballistic missiles, stuff like that. In many ways, they were well ahead of the Allies. They didn't have an A-bomb, but a lot of people in the States, including Einstein, thought they were close, and that scared the crap out of everyone. When it looked like Germany would fall, everyone started looking at Russia. It was already clear they were going to be the next enemy. Some top brass thought that war with them would follow, pretty much right after beating the Nazis. It was also clear that the Russians would reach Berlin first, and would take whatever tech the Germans had built, and the people who built them. Tamika sat very still, holding the phone. This was it. She could just feel it. "The short version?" Marvin continued. "We wanted to get what we could, and keep it out of Russian hands. That included people, the scientists, technical assistants, lab staff who had been working for the Nazis. Not just in weapons development, but research and experimentation, some of it seriously illegal. And I'm talking war crimes illegal. Like, the Nazis had been building these jet and rocket-powered aircraft, right? They were traveling faster and faster. So they wanted to know what that kind of velocity and pressure would do to a pilot. They built ways to test that stuff, using animals or, at first, the scientists themselves. But that was slow and cautious, as you'd imagine. Why experiment on yourself when you had millions of people who you decided weren't really people at all?" "The concentration camps," said Tamika, with a kind of numb horror. "Exactly," said Marvin. "Seriously heavy shit. We don't even know how many people died in the process. A lot. And then the war ended. We liberated the camps, rounded up the people who had been doing all this stuff, whisked them away before they could be tried at Nuremberg, wiped their records clean, gave them made-up bios, and made them U.S. citizens. When Truman set the program up, it was called Operation Overcast, but it was renamed Paperclip later. We took their data, their research, their ideas, their technology, and we slotted them right into our own weapons and aerospace programs. When everyone started freaking out about Sputnik and the Soviet space program, guess who led NASA's charge to put men on the moon? The Operation Paperclip boys. Werner von Braun, who designed the Saturn V rockets for the Apollo missions, had spent the war building V-2 missiles for the Nazis. He went from devastating London to being hailed as a U.S. national hero practically overnight. He wasn't the only one. Debus, Rudolph, Strughold. All these guys had been high on the Allies' wanted lists because they were integral to the Nazi war effort. Then they were working for us, and everyone conveniently forgot how they'd been using their talents before. Some worked for NASA. Some went to White Sands in New Mexico to work on missile systems. Some went to the rocket fuel lab in Louisiana or Missouri. A whole bunch of engineers went into combat aircraft development.
"But we don't have complete lists of all the people we brought over?" Tamika asked.
"What are we talking? 10? 20?
Marvin laughed.
"Last estimates I saw said something in the region of 1,500.
Tamika gasped.
"And this is real, right, Marvin? It's not the tinfoil hat crowd stuff."
"Absolutely real. The authorities, though they're still pretty stingy with specifics, came clean on this long ago. Truman said they shouldn't include known Nazis. I mean, people affiliated with the SS. Or actual Nazi party members. Just Germans who worked for their country's war effort. But the Pentagon ignored him. To cover their tracks, a lot of records got lost or buried."
"Are any of these people still alive?" Tamika asked,
picturing the lounge at the Hollows and its dozing geriatrics.
"I doubt it," said Marvin. "They would have had to have been in their 20s or 30s at the earliest during the war. So they'd be like 100 now. So it's possible, I guess. But it's unlikely."
"Any women?"
"Not that I've ever seen," said Marvin. "Like I said, the records are incomplete, but there were pictures. I've never heard of any women being involved."
"Why?"
"Just wondering," said Tamika. "Anything new on Katerina Lundegrass or any of the others?"
"Not yet. I've got someone poking around in military archives, though. I'll let you know if I hear anything."
"Just remember,
discretion. My middle name."
"One more thing," said Tamika. "If Paperclip is public knowledge, why would anyone want to hide away people connected to the program?"
"Today? No reason. Plus, as you say, they're all dead now. Sounds like you're dealing with something else."
"Yeah," Tamika agreed vaguely. "I guess so. Thanks, Marvin."
She hung up and lay for a long time, staring at the stained ceiling, her mind turning over everything she'd learned so far. She felt like an archaeologist trying to reassemble a pot, piece by fractured piece. Nothing made sense. She turned out the light and missed Dion's presence beside her for the first time since she'd left New York. She wondered if she was still in the same world as she'd been in only yesterday, when she'd been confidently giving interviews and writing copy about the idiocy and credulity of others. Was this what it was like? The special madness of the conspiracy theorist? Surrounded by fragments of something you can't quite see, and which might only exist in your own mind? Well, tomorrow, she thought, remembering Katerina Lundegrass's plan to meet her in the church at Locust Lake. She would find out.
23. Jersey, Poland, 1945.
The Russians slapped me on the back and called me Jiri Malchika, which I took to mean child hero or something similar. I did not feel heroic. When Mrs. Habernik battled her way through the throng, all of them drinking and singing, I buried my face in her apron and would not look at anyone. She had a few words of Russian, and one of the soldiers spoke a little Polish, and she answered what questions she could. She called herself Bronikowski now, her name before she married, she whispered to me.
"Easier that way," she said.
I nodded. I asked her about the resistance fighters, but she winced at the memory and shook her head.
"All of them?"
I gasped, tears starting to my eyes once more, though I had spent no more than a few minutes with them. I thought of the one who had called herself Maxine, and though I tried to tell myself that they would not have minded dying fighting the Germans, I could not believe it. The Russians impounded everything they could find, including the remaining cargo plane. The German crew and soldiers who had survived the firefight with the Soviet troops had been rounded up and were being kept in paddocks at the end of the airstrip, under heavy guard. Many Germans had been killed, their bodies heaped for mass burial. I saw no sign of Ungerleiter, the man who had ordered my brother's death.
Either he got away on the first plane, or died at my hands on the second. The thought left me numb, feeling nothing, as if some part of me had been shot away in the fight, and I would never be of any use again. Mrs. Habernicht, now Bronikowski, told me that the war, our war, was finally over. One of the soldiers gave me a glass of vodka to celebrate, but I neither smiled nor sang, as the others danced drunkenly around. I kept staring at my hands, as if they might have belonged to someone else, wanting only to forget the last hours, the last years, even my past before the war. I was afraid of the Russians. It was clear that they were here to stay, and that Poland, as I had known it before the war, was gone. With nothing to hold me there, I resolved to escape to France or England and start over. But even as I prepared my final escape, I was still haunted by the memories of my family and by the possibility that some of them may have survived. I needed to be sure, and that meant going east. I told Mrs. Bronikowski, Habernicht, of my plan, and though I had expected her to try to talk me out of it, she just nodded sadly and told me she would get together some food and clothes for my journey. When it came time to part, she pressed a piece of paper with her address printed carefully on it, so that I could send word of what she called my adventures, and kissed me once on the cheek. She wept for both of us, and then, when she went to the shop to buy soap, I slipped away, leaving a note that contained the thanks I could not speak. I moved through the pine-scented woods, as I had first come, sleeping rough for 2 nights, until I found a village where I could catch a ride on a freight train toward Krakow. I spent a week there, found the place where we had lived, even spoke to old Mrs. Liska, who had raised poultry for the shops and restaurants my parents had frequented before the war. She looked different now. Everyone did. But she remembered me, and wished she had good news, or any news. When I told her about Ishmael, she put her hands up in front of her face, her fingers splayed as if she was catching a ball, and closed her eyes. She stood like that so long that I did not know what to do. And when she looked at me again, she seemed older and sadder than ever. So I thanked her, though she had told me nothing, and left. I fought the crowds outside the temporary offices, the awkward alliance of the old Polish bureaucracy that had been absorbed into the new Soviet order, and stood in lines for 3 days, reciting my parents' names and those of every relative I knew, no matter how distant. At first, I was cheered that they had records of where they had gone, but as each one was chased down, the awful truth became harder and harder to avoid. I had not dared seriously consider the possibility, and the fact of those stamped documents, presented to me by a hard-faced woman whose eyes betrayed only weariness, left me hollow, emptied out of feeling, of self, so that for the next few days I experienced a kind of madness. My family was gone, all of them. As the stories of the camps came out, and the full horror of the Nazi occupation came to light, what little hope I had left faded to nothing, so that all that was left was a kind of hard kernel made of defiance rather than faith. When everything is lost, it is better not to remember what you had, and I had nothing. A week later, I left Krakow forever. The Russian chokehold on the borders was tightening every day, and it was getting harder to move around, so I went where I could without going through checkpoints and waiting for my papers to be approved. In my case, this meant the long trek north to Gdansk, cushioned as best I could in an empty boxcar. Once in the port, I would find a container ship bound for the west. I boarded the first ship I could, stowing away below decks, but two of the crew found me and threw me back on the dock, leaving me with a bloody lip and an empty purse. I was more cautious thereafter, watching the moored ships, and trying to get a sense of their schedules before risking another attempt. There was nothing directly bound for France or England, but I eventually got one to Gothenburg, which would do for a start. My food rations were getting low, and though I had grown used to eating little, I would need to replenish my supplies somehow in Sweden, though I knew nothing of the language or customs of the place, so finding work seemed unlikely. They found me on the third day, and though they did not beat me, they would not feed me, and said I had to get off before they reached port. The captain, a Lithuanian who stank of alcohol at all hours, would not, he said, be responsible for smuggling undocumented immigrants, no matter how much I argued that the Swedes would not turn me away. In sight of the cranes and warehouses of the Gothenburg docks, he put me on a smoky tug that moored alongside for the purpose, and sent me to another ship that was about to leave port. It was an altogether bigger, sleeker, more modern-looking vessel than I had left, and it had guns. "This is a warship," I protested. "I am not a soldier." "Or a sailor," said the Lithuanian, sucking on a ragged cigarette, "and therefore not my problem." The men on board spoke English, and for a moment I thought I had been lucky, that I would be disembarking in London. But when I was called before the duty officer, I learned otherwise. He was perhaps 30, athletic and clean-cut, with bright blue eyes that considered me with a touch of humor. His uniform was crisply pressed and spotless, except for a smear of oil on one sleeve that he kept daubing at irritably. "Speak English?" he demanded. "A little," I said. Before the war, one of our neighbors had married a pretty English girl who had made a game of learning Polish from the local kids. In the process, because I liked words, I had picked up some of her own language. The language of Shakespeare, she had called it. I do not know if she survived the war. "You might want to work on that," he said. He smirked, as if at a private joke, considering me, and extended a strong hand. I took it, my own hand feeling small and feeble in his, and he gave it a single brisk shake. He spoke again, but I did not understand all he said, and instead framed a single question. "Where are we going?" "We're an escort destroyer," he said. "The USS Kitchener. We'll be joining a troop ship out of Cherbourg, bound for New York City." I stared at him. "America?" I said. "The one and only. No other stops. Take it or leave it." And so I crossed the Atlantic. I planned to take the next ship back to Europe as soon as we reached port. But I was well fed on the journey, well treated by the sailors, and the feared encounters with lost U-boats never happened, so that by the time we reached the extraordinary skyline of New York, I could not remember why I had not planned to stay. I had also made good progress with my English, speaking with the crew whenever I could, and reading voraciously throughout the voyage. The captain had given me some dog-eared miniature paperbacks, mysteries and a couple of classics by Twain and Dickens, and these I consumed, the hard work of reading turning to pleasure as my vocabulary expanded. When the weather was calm, I sat in the sun on the deck with my books. The pages bubbled and uneven from the salt spray, and when I ran into a word I didn't know, I'd approach one of the crew and ask. It got so they saw me coming, and competed with each other to provide the best definitions, bickering good-humoredly, working their way up the chain of command when they needed a ruling. Somehow, without really meaning to, I had become the USS Kitchener's mascot. The crew talked about their hometowns, their sweethearts, the things they had seen in the war, but no one ever asked me what I had been through, and I started to suspect that they had been ordered not to talk to me about it. The captain knew about my family, the ghetto, the Wenceslas mine, even that fateful day when the planes tried to leave and the Russians came. because I had told him in my first meeting with him, blurting it all out, in the hope that he wouldn't send me back. I came through Ellis Island on the last day of August, 1945, throwing my Polish papers over the side of the ferry, and saying that I was 19 so I could work. Captain Jennings sponsored my citizenship, and no one seemed to doubt that I was as old as I had claimed, though I was still slightly built.
"It's the eyes," said one crewman. "It's like they came from someone else, or they've seen... I don't know."
He was grinning when he started speaking, his tone light, like he was merely remarking on a curiosity. But something happened to the smile midway through the thought, and it went away, leaving him with an awkward, haunted look. And though he was talking about my eyes, he couldn't hold them. I felt strange. It reinforced the idea that I was not one of them, though what I was now, I did not know. I had been a Polish Jew, a child. I wasn't sure which of those things still applied in this vast and unfamiliar land, and when I thought about it for long, I felt a tide of panic rising in my chest. I had no friends, no family, no sense of who I was, and no way of putting food in my belly, let alone of building any kind of real life here. As if to prove the point, I struggled in my dealings with the immigration people. Though my English was much improved, I did not understand everything.